This is the first lecture. I'm going to just overview some recent progress in my domain.
Okay. Thank you. So the basic idea of conform bootstrap is that we are going to use conform symmetry and crossing symmetry to constrain physical variables non-perturbatively and without using UA details. I think most of you probably already knew the basic constraint for CFT, so I'm going to be brief. So the constraints we are going to use are the first constraints. We assume our theory have conformal symmetry. So all the operators will be in representation of conformal group. And that fits two-point function and three-point function. The scaling dimension of the operators are related to a critical exponent in condensed matter experiment. Also, from the three-point function, from the expression of the three-point function, we can conclude the scalar-scalar spinning operator will be zero for all the spin if the two scalars are identical. So this is something we're going to use later. Second constraint is the operator product expansion. Namely, when we multiply two primary operator, that can be have a linear expansion in terms of all the primary operators in the theory. So conform symmetry fits this C structure. It fits the relative coefficient between primary operator and the descendant operator. So once we have OPE, we can use the multiplication rule to evaluate any four-point function. So that gave us a conformal partial wave decomposition. So we can, for identical scalars, when we contract the first two operator and the last two operator, that have an expansion in terms of conformal block. GUV is the conformal block, and it's a known function. U and V are related to the space-time coordinate x1 to x4. So Z and Z bar is just a change of coordinate. Last assumption is the crossing symmetry. Namely, when we use OPE to evaluate four-point function, there are two ways to do it. We can multiply 1 and 2 first, 3 and 4. Or we can multiply 1 and 4 first, then multiply 2 and 3. So different way of evaluating four-point function gave us an equation. So this should be we should get the same result. So this equation, we can rewrite it in a compact way in terms of F. So F is called the convolved block. The basic idea of numerical bootstrap is that we first pick up a set of correlator. For each four-point correlator, we write down bootstrap equation. And we try to use numerics to explore the equation. So the basic logic is that we first truncate the equation to finite dimension. So the bootstrap equation is a functional equation. It holds at various points in space-time. So that's infinite dimensional equation. To do numerics, we have to truncate this infinite dimensional equation to finite dimension. So one way to do it is we take this convolved block F and do Taylor expansion on this equation. So after the Taylor expansion, we keep first a few derivatives. Therefore, this function f are represented by finite dimensional vector c as a coefficient in the Taylor expansion. So now this equation is a summation over some vectors, finite dimensional vectors, with a coefficient lambda square. So unitarity tells us lambda square has to be positive. Therefore, this is summation of some vector with positive coefficient, and it should be zero. So the basic idea of numerical bootstrap is that we try to ask, can we find a plane such that all the vectors are on one side of the plane? So if the let's imagine the vectors are three-dimensional vector. So if we draw those vector, and we find the scenario looks like this, in which case we couldn't find a plane such that all the vectors are on one side of the plane. In this case, we conclude it's possible for the equation to hold. On the other hand, if we can find a plane such that all the vectors appear in this summation are on one side of the plane. So if this is the case, we conclude it's impossible for this equation to hold, no matter which OPE coefficient you choose. Why? Because no matter what OPE coefficient you choose, when you sum up left-hand side, it's always have a positive component in the normal direction of the plane. Therefore, the left-hand side, once you project to the normal direction, it's positive. But the right-hand side is zero. Therefore, we conclude this equation cannot hold. So the problem to find the plane can be translated to semi-definite program. And we have effective numerical package to solve it.
I'm sorry, could you explain why unitarity imposed that constraint?
I will explain a little bit later. So right now, I'm just to tell you the very basic idea of numerical bootstrap. So next, I will just review a few progress follow this idea, and later today and later this week, we'll go to really technical aspect of it. So So if you pick in three dimension, if you take correlators involve sigma and epsilon. Sigma and epsilon are scalars, and they carry Z2 symmetry. Sigma are Z2 odd, epsilon are Z2 even. So the bootstrap equation from those correlators, and if we in addition make some assumption such that sigma and epsilon are the only two relevant scalars. And you follow this idea, try to ask whether you can find a plane such that to show the equation cannot hold. Then this is the result. In this plot, everywhere you can explicitly construct that plane. Those choice of delta sigma and delta epsilon are excluded because of the fact that you can find a plan to show the equation cannot hold. Except in this small island, then inside this small island, you couldn't find such plan. So this is the most precise computation on 3D Ising CFT. We can also apply this idea to 3D super Ising. So 3D super Ising are given by this Lagrangian. So sigma is a scalar, psi is a fermion. So this Lagrangian have n equals to 1 supersymmetry. If we bootstrap four-point function of sigma, and if we also impose the fact that it has through the symmetry, then you can show delta sigma and delta sigma prime. Sigma prime is the next operator after sigma. It has its parity or the super conformal primary. So the scaling dimension has to be within this small island. Everywhere outside, you can explicitly find that plane and exclude that possibility.
Can I ask a question? So only by just doing simple push up and SUSY, you already get island here. Mm. So just by you imposing the single constraint, you get island here.
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, but for this, we also need to impose SUSY symmetry. So this is a super conformal CFT. This sigma have super descendant. We have to fix that relation between super primary and the super the descendant of the super primary.
I see.
And then from there we can get this island.
I guess you also assume there is no other relations.
Oh yes, we also assume a certain operator are the only relevant operator in the theory. So also we can apply this to Owen symmetry. For Owen symmetry, if we consider all four-point functions involving Owen vector, Owen scalar, and Owen traceless symmetric tensor, that constrains the scaling dimension for delta phi, scaling dimension of the vector, and delta s, the scaling dimension of the singlet. Into this very small island. So this plot is for O2. This plot is for O3. So if you apply similar idea to a 3D Gauss-Neuville-Yerkawa, this is the Lagrangian for Gauss-Neuville-Yerkawa. Phi is a scalar, psi is a fermion carry Owen carry Owen index, and they are coupled through the Yerkawa coupling. So by bootstrap, all correlates involving psi, phi, and the singlet, we can constrain the scaling dimension into this small island for different n. So psi are Owen vectors. Now, there is a computational aspect to this story. So the conformal bootstrap is actually, when you think about it, it's quite interesting. They are really formal theories. We start from a very basic formal constraint. But in the end, we can predict scaling dimensions related to condensed matter experiment. So the formal theory, the basic idea of the constraint, people actually knew it a long time ago. So the bootstrap idea was invented by Polyakov in 1960s. But then at that time, we don't have effective computational tool to really explore those constraints. The conformal block F are computed, first computed in 2001 by Dooland and Osborne. And since 2008, people developed many effective numerical methods to evaluate the convolved block and to explore the causing equation to find this plane alpha, and also find effective method to scan over the theory space. There are also many analytical understanding of the bootstrap equation. So in next few slides, I'm going to overview the various computational techniques and challenges. So the typical computation in numerical bootstrap looks like the following. We first choose a point in the theory space. For example, we might assume a certain operator have certain scaling dimensions, and truncate the bootstrap equation, and translate the problem to semi-definite program. And we solve that specific semi-definite program. That tells us this specific choice of the scaling dimension is allowed or disallowed. So that's one computation of semi-definite program. And we may find our choice of parameter are disallowed. Then we go to another parameter, repeat this process, compute another semi-definite program. And it may tell us that point are allowed. So in this way, we can test point by point in the theory space. So we need two types of algorithms. One is the scan algorithm, which point we want to test. So the most naive way you could test a grid of points in the theory space. But if the dimension of the space is quite high, that could be a challenge. And the second type of algorithm is the SDP solver algorithm. For each point, we need an effective algorithm to solve the SDP. So that leads to two challenges. First challenge, if the theory space is very high, then carve out the theory space is difficult. So for example, for the O2 story, although I showed you an island in delta phi and delta s, but actually the island is a six-dimensional island. The island is in delta phi, delta s, and delta t, and three OPE coefficient ratios. So you can imagine if you do a random test or if you test a grid of points in six-dimensional space, that's very challenging. So the cost would be grow exponentially to the dimension of the space. So that's just a typical phenomenon of curse of dimensionality. And another type of challenge is that as we include more and more correlators in the theory, we have more and more constraints, and the bootstrap equation, number of bootstrap equations get bigger and bigger. That translates to a bigger semi-definite program. So this then solving the semi-definite program could be very slow. So we have those challenges. The typical scenario in numerical bootstrap is that our final goal is try to solve some CFT and try to find CFT data. But in order to have access to complicated CFT data or complicated CFT, we usually need to study a large set of correlators. So just to give you a few examples here. For easy model, we can find a very small island by studying those three correlators. But for O2 and O3, we have to study much more correlators in order to find a small island. Also, from those correlators, we can have access to O3 operator up to range 4 operators. Because in those correlators, we have TT OPE, so that's range 2. Therefore, in the TT OPE, we have access to range 4 operators. However, if we want to have access to higher rank operator, we must include more operators in the correlator. Therefore, if we want to access more data, in general, we have to consider a larger set of correlators. But then, that means we have to overcome those challenges. So in general, the safety data we can get out of numerical bootstrap is constrained by current computational technique. That's why we're always in need of better algorithms. So next, I'm going to reveal a few algorithms we figured out to solve some problem. So in this slide, I showed you to bootstrap O2 and O3, we have to scan over a six-dimensional space. That's a very challenging task. How we did it is that we found a very efficient algorithm to quickly scan over the OP space. So to scan the ratio of OP coefficient, there is an effective algorithm called the cutting surface algorithm. If you use this algorithm, the cost is not grow exponentially with number of parameter. Instead, it grow linearly with the number of OP coefficient. And this algorithm leads to the success in O2, O3, and GNY. Roughly speaking, this algorithm, once you scan one point, you test one point in the OP space, that roughly cuts the allowed region by half, so as shown in those plot. Therefore, after you scan a finite number of points, you either find a point that is allowed, or you rule out the entire space. Another technique. Yes.
When you're cutting these in half, are you ruling out the other half, or are you only interested in going to an allowed point?
What happened in this computation is that you first choose three delta, you fix those delta, then you have three OP coefficient ratios to scan. Then inside this three-dimensional space, you test one point. That test roughly could rule out half of the space, and you have another half which is allowed. Then you keep doing this. In every scan, you cut allowed region in half. In those plot, those are the outside this volume, it's already explicitly ruled out. Then you only need to test points inside, and after a few points, this region gets smaller and smaller. Then you might find an allowed point or rule out the entire space. Then you conclude your choice of three delta are allowed or not allowed. Then this essentially reduces the problem to a three-dimensional problem. That's how you can find this island for O2 and O3. Another type of algorithm is called the navigator function. So before the computation I showed you are feasible infeasible computation. We choose a point, we test, and ask that point are allowed or disallowed. That's another type of technique. We can reformulate the problem to define a function in the theory space such that this function is a continuous function, but also it's negative in the allowed region and positive in the disallowed region. So this is an example of the navigator functions. This is corresponding to the Ising island. Ising island is here, delta sigma, delta epsilon. They are only allowed inside this island, outside are disallowed. And the corresponding navigator function is this yellow surface. So once you have this function, you can start from a point which is disallowed because the navigator function here is positive. Then you can minimize the navigator function and gradually go to the island. And once you are inside the island, you can try to maximize delta sigma and delta epsilon, but keep navigator function to be negative. So you can navigate through the allowed region, go to the boundary of the island. So use this type of technique, it's possible to scan very high dimensional space. So the algorithm for navigator function is that we still do semi-definite program computation. and we pick up a point in the theory space. After the semi-definite program computation, the output of the semi-definite program tell you two things. One is the value for the navigate function. Another one is the gradient for the navigate function. Therefore, you can choose to follow the gradient to go to the allowed region, or you can maximize certain parameter. Recently, there are another algorithm developed to try to address the two challenges simultaneously. So remember, we have two challenges. One is solving SDP might be slow. Another one is scan the theory space could be a challenge. This is a new algorithm try to treat two optimization. One is the scan problem in the theory space. Another is the problem to solving SDP. And this method try to do two optimization simultaneously. Basically, in each SDP, so the vertical axis here is the error in semi-definite program. We will talk about this precisely in Thursday. Once you minimize the error to zero, you solved the semi-definite program. But in this method, we were not going to solve the entire SDP. Instead, we just solve partially solve the SDP. Then we start to update the theory space. We move to another point in the theory space, and we solve that SDP a little bit. Then we go to another SDP, and we go to another SDP. So instead of solving this entire SDP, we just spend a little bit computational cost in each SDP. And in this way, that can save a lot of computational resources. So there are some software to do numerical computation, numerical bootstrap computation. First two programs are used to compute a conformal block. Then SDPP is the C++ package to solve SDP. SDP. And there is another code, C++ program, SDP skydiving. This implemented the algorithm. I implemented this algorithm. Also, there is a patch called AutoBoot, which can derive bootstrap iteration automatically for many symmetries. There are two packages. Are bootstrap framework, which integrate all of those package, and also implement various scan algorithms. So the Hyperion and the simple Hyperion is a Haskell package. Simple boot is a mathematical package. There are also other packages, other bootstrap framework. So in this tutorial, we are going to focused on the Hyperion and the simple boot package. So the plan for this week, we have the goal of this mini course is really to teach you how to use Hyperion and simple boot to do actual computations. So in the morning, we will give a lecture, talk about more theoretical aspect, but we will try to brief. The lecture is just try to prepare you for minimal ingredient for the tutorial. So in the afternoon, there is one tutorial for Hyperion, another tutorial for simple boot. There is 1 hour break after each tutorial, and during the break, you are supposed to run the sample code, do exercise, and enjoy coffee. Oh. Why you laugh?
It's not break.
So today we are trying to scan the 3D thing to operate the system. We are going to find the island for 3D thing. Tomorrow, we will go through the O1 vector scalar traceless symmetric system and also try to learn how to use cutting surface algorithm. And Wednesday is about GNY model. Thursday, we will talk about navigator function, and on Friday, we talk about skydiving algorithm. Okay, so any questions so far? Okay, so in next 1 hour, I will go through the 3D thing sigma epsilon system and try to derive the bootstrap equation, which we will use this afternoon to find the island. I will be brief for the theoretical aspect. If you are not familiar with, if you are new to Bootstrap, this is a good reference you can look at. So let me start by consider four different scalar phi1 to phi4. And the conformal partial wave decomposition is this one. So we fuse phi1, phi2, then fuse phi3, phi4. This is a block. G is the conformal block. So we can write down the decomposition for this and the decomposition for this. So this one is just this one, but with 1 and 3 exchange. So on the 1, 3 exchange, U V will exchange, and Z go to 1 minus Z. This equation can be written in this form. So F is a combination of G. Here it's two equations. One have upper sign, another one have lower sign. But it's really just on the UV exchange, this piece can be this equation on the UV exchange could be. We can write out the even part on the UV exchange and write out the odd part on the UV exchange. That's these two equations. And for generic four scalars, if the scalar are all different, let me denote this equation simply as 1, 2, 3, 4. So then you could write down equation for, let's say, 2, 1, 3, 4. So there are many equations, but only three are independent. So only those three are independent equations. And if the scalar, some of the scalar are identical, you could have a less number of equations. For example, if they are all identical, of course you only have one independent equation. But if phi1 equals to phi2, phi3 equals to phi4, then you can count here. This go to this, but these two go to this one. So only these two are independent equation. Now let's consider.
Could you explain what the plus minus sign was again in the F?
Oh, yes. So this F is. We can write down this equation, and this equation, left-hand side is a function on UV. So for any function you can in UV, you can decompose to UV even piece on the UV exchange and odd piece on the UV exchange. So do this, you write out the even and odd part, that's these two iterations. So as an exercise, if you never did this, try to derive this equation from here.
Sorry, are the equations the same for Minkowski signature and Euclidean signature?
Yes, here I didn't specify its Minkowski or in actual computation, the Z and Z bar are constrained between 0 and 1.
So,
So if you take Z and Z bar to be complex, here we take Z and Z bar to be independent, that's totally leading. Or you can take Z and Z bar to be complex variable and take Z bar to be complex conjugate of Z. That way you get Lorentzian.
But all your operators are spatial. All the correlators are in spatial
sense. Oh, yes. Okay, so next, let's assume we consider safety with Z2 symmetry. We assume phi1 is Z2 order, phi2 is Z2 even. If you use counting here, the independent equation you can write down are those. Phi one, and this one. This two is coming from this counting. If the operator here and the operator here are the same, then from this situation, this term will be same as this term. Therefore, you don't have the minus sign. That equation is zero. You only have plus sign. That's why in this situation, you only have minus sign in F. But for this equation, you have plus sign and minus sign. So totally, there are five equations. We can rewrite this five equation in matrix form. So that equation become this one. It's just a trivial rewriting, but you can try to check it. So for example, let's check this term. So this equation are coming from here with minus sign. So if you contract this 2x2 matrix by this OPE, it gives you this 2 OPE. And on this side, this term are from here. And using this relation. So this relation is something you can derive from the three-point function on first slide. Okay, so now, we try to apply similar logic. We try to find a functional that rule out our assumption. So the rough logic is that we start with this equation. We make some assumptions about the spectrum. For example, we can assume the intermediate operator takes a certain scaling dimension. So that's assumption about those vectors. Then we test whether our assumption is true or not. So how we do that? We try to find a linear functional alpha, which is five component. And this functional linear functional alpha acting on the crossing vector. So acting on V even, the result is a 2x2 matrix. So V even is this five component vector, each entry is 2x2 matrix. So alpha acting on V even, the result is a 2x2 matrix. We demand this 2x2 matrix is positive semi-definite. The definition of positive semi-definite is that when we contract with contract the 2x2 matrix with any two-dimensional vector, the result is positive for arbitrary choice of the OP coefficient. And similarly, we demand alpha acting on V world is positive. So if we can find such linear function, then we let the alpha acting on both sides of the equation. On the left-hand side, no matter which OP coefficient we choose, this term will always be positive, non-negative. On the right-hand side, it's zero. Therefore, if we can find such linear function, it rule out our assumption on the spectrum.
Sorry, can I ask why is that that like positivity test? Why that equation has to be positive or greater than zero? Why alpha dot that V is greater than zero?
Good. So here. We demand this condition, and we ask whether this alpha exists or not. So this is a condition I demand. I might not find this alpha. If I don't find this alpha, then I conclude my assumption on the spectrum are not excluded. So our assumption might be true. But if I demand this condition and I find the alpha, then I conclude my assumption about spectrum are 100% ruled out. So this is the basic logic of conformal numerical bootstrap. Is this cleared? Thanks for the question. So you, if anything is not clear, please ask. So now let's try to explore this equation in more detail. First, we knew some operator in this expansion. In Z2 even sector, we knew vacuum must exist. So let's isolate this term. So vacuum have scaling dimension zero, spin zero, and we also know the OPE. So lambda sigma sigma vacuum is one, lambda epsilon epsilon vacuum is one. And epsilon is Z2 even operator, so it will appear in V even. That's this term. And sigma is Z2 order, it will appear here. I put the rest of the summation here. Now we can make one more assumption. Lambda sigma epsilon sigma should equals to lambda sigma sigma epsilon. You can see this from three-point function. Then with this assumption, we can combine these two terms. So these two terms can be combined in like this. So this term from here, this term in this entry, we have this OPE. So now the equation go to this equation. Identity term, this V theta term here, and summation of the rest of the operators. So now I want to talk about a little bit more on unitarity. Unitarity means all the states in the Hilbert space have a positive norm. That leads to two consequences. First one, we have unitarity bound. delta has to be larger than a certain value in order to guarantee all states have positive norm. For example, if you use the conformal algebra, you can show P is the translation operator, it's just a partial. For the field, it's just a partial. So for P acting on the any primary state, you evaluate the norm that gives you two delta times the norm of O. But if both are positive, then delta also has to be positive. So if you evaluate this for all the descendant, the conclusion is that the operator should scaling dimension of primary operator should be larger than delta unitary. That's for spin zero is this value, for spinning operator is this one. Now the consequence is the OP coefficient should be real. First of all, any Hermitian operator, OP coefficient is real. You write out a three-point function, take complex conjugate on both sides. If they are Hermitian operator, left-hand side doesn't change. So, and this piece doesn't change. Therefore, lambda star should equals to lambda. However, if some state have negative norm, that means the two-point function, instead of plus one, will have minus one here. So two-point function is related to the norm of this operator. However, if we insist to normalize it to be plus one, if we insist we want to normalize it to be plus one, that means we want to scale phi to be I phi. Then if phi is Hermitian, I phi become anti-Hermitian, then this OP become imaginary. So therefore, if no state has negative norm, then all the OP coefficient is real. But if you do have negative norm, some OP could be imaginary or complex. So,
so is that a reality for this OP coefficient requires some any anti-unitary symmetry of the underlying theory, or it does not?
The unitary safety and the non-unitary safety. So for this tutorial, we're going to study unitary safety.
So maybe my question is, if this constraint like rely on the assumption that the underlying theory has some time reversal symmetry or parity symmetry, this consequence too?
It rely on all the states have positive norm. That's not necessarily true for all CFT, but we are going to study the CFTs with positive norm in Hilbert space. So now let's go through the assumptions for 3D easing spectrum. So we pick two number for delta sigma and delta epsilon. And we assume sigma and epsilon have those scaling dimension. We also assume all other spin zero operators have dimension larger than three. So basically, we are assuming delta sigma and delta epsilon are the only relevant operators. Actually, this assumption is slightly different from assuming these two are the only relevant operator. I'm going to talk about that later. And we also assume all the spinning operator have scaling dimension larger than unitarity bound. And we assume all the OP coefficient are real. So those are the assumptions we need. And the problem we want to ask is, does our choice of these two numbers are compatible with this bootstrap iteration? Namely, if I pick a number for delta sigma and pick a number for delta epsilon, you can pick the rest of the data, all the lambdas and the deltas compatible with those assumptions. And we asked, is it possible this situation hold? So we can do following test to check whether this situation can hold or not. We try to find a linear function of alpha such that alpha acting on the vacuum block is 1. Acting on v theta is positive. Acting on spin 0, v even are positive for delta larger than 3. And same for v odd spin 0. And we demand alpha acting on the rest of terms are positive for delta larger than unitarity bound. So here for v even, we demand for even spin, because all the odd spin cannot exist, because if phi are identical, only even spin can appear. Okay, so we asked whether this alpha exists or not. If this alpha exists, then we conclude our choice of delta sigma and delta epsilon are not allowed. So those conditions are corresponding to assumption here. Is this clear to you? Okay. So how do we do this test? First step, we take we truncate the alpha. So alpha is a linear function. It eat a function and give us a number. First, we can take alpha to be derivatives evaluated at 1/2. Z equals to z bar equals to 1/2, and we truncate the derivative up to some order lambda. Second step, this block F can be approximate. The derivative of F on Z and Z bar evaluated at 1/2 can be approximate in following way. So this derivative can be written as a polynomial times a non-polynomial part. The non-polynomial part looks like this. It's some number to the power delta. And in the denominator, there are some pole in delta. But the interesting thing is that all those poles are below unitarity bound. Therefore, this whole term is positive if we demand delta larger than delta unitary. So these factors are the same for all the Fs appear in v even and v odd. And this polynomial, there is an effective way to compute this polynomial, and this C++ package can do that for you. Okay, now the test alpha acting on v even now become, we can factor out this non-polynomial piece, and we have a summation over the alpha mn with the block, but now in v even we only have polynomials, and since this part is always positive, so we only need to test alpha acting on v even, but only keep the polynomial part. We demand that is positive for delta larger than a certain gap. Yes.
Is there anything special with z equals to 1/2?
So this property is true at z equals to z bar equals to 1/2. So if we choose, let's say if we choose z equals to z bar equals to other value, then this piece, okay, so if we choose one point, that's still true. So in principle, you can do it at 1/3. But if you couldn't do it for both 1/2 and 1/3, in that case, this non-polynomial part will be different.
So z equals to 1/2 correspond to what kind of relation of this point in coordinate space? So maybe what is the definition of z? Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Point, that's why it's chosen often.
Yeah, so
the position in the four-point function, the combination of positions.
Yeah, the definition of Z is here. And under 1/3 change, U go to V, Z go to 1 minus Z. Therefore, z equals to 1/2 is symmetric under UV exchange.
So z equals to 1/2 correspond to what kind of relation among these 4 points? So in space.
It's corresponding to corresponding to a configuration that when you exchange x1 and x3, that point is invariant. But from numerics point of view, it's not a special point. You could do this test at z equals to 1/3. Just then in the change channel, you have to do it at 3/3. But 1/3 and 3/3 have the same non-polynomial part, so that's fine.
I think geometrically it's the cross ratio. If you form the crosses made by those 4 points and take the ratio of them, should be that the cross ratio is 1.
And you can also put these 4 points on the four vertices of a square. And then you can just compute z equals z bar for that.
Sorry, so is there a simple explanation why the non-polynomial piece is not depend on the external dimension? So why it's not depend on delta 1, 2, and delta 3, 4?
Why non-polynomial not depends on...
Is there a simple explanation why, if it's depend on delta 1, 2, or 3, 4, you cannot factorize that?
This is special in this setup. For other setup, this will depend on. So in general, it could depend on.
I see.
I have a question.
Yes.
Does alpha also have another index which runs over these 5?
Yes. So alpha itself, this alpha mn itself is 5 component.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, so, and also, we want to do this test, but in principle, we have to do this test for infinite number of spin. But in practice, we will only do this test for spin up to certain cutoff. Basically, once you do this test up to certain maximum spin, then for the larger spin, you can easily, so let's say you do this test and you find alpha exclude the choice of delta sigma and delta epsilon. Then once you construct this alpha, you can use this alpha to test the rest of the spin, and you can check they actually automatically satisfy the positivity. Later this week, we can use the navigator function to test. Basically, as L gets larger and larger, the effect on the numerics decay exponentially. So for larger spin, it essentially doesn't matter. Okay. Now this problem become polynomial programming. So it looks like this. We try to find the alpha. M is a matrix. MJ is a K component vector, and the entry of each component is the matrix. So we let alpha acting on M0 equals to 1, and alpha acting on MJ is positive semi-definite for all the J. So those M are the V-even, V-order, and for different L. And now this K index run over that five component, but also run over the derivatives. So this is polynomial programming. And this type of problem can be solved using SDPB. So the input of SDPB looks like this. So this is in mathematical format. The input is no objective, that's the vector, not the vector, and some matrix. So that this format is corresponding to this problem. We want to maximize alpha acting on the objective. We want to maximize this quantity, alpha acting on objective, such that alpha dot the normalization vector is 1, and alpha dot mj are positive for so, and mj are m plus 1 component vector, and each entry is a matrix. But for different j, the dimension of the matrix would be different. And each entry in the matrix is a polynomial. So we demand alpha acting on mj as a matrix are positive semi-definite for x larger than zero. So this problem, you can put it here. So objective normalization, those are the polynomial matrix. And the prefect is the non-polynomial part in the conformal block.
So in the previous things you described, the objective was just zero because you're trying to check for...
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that now. So we can use this in feasibility mode. Basically, in feasibility mode, we just ask whether alpha exists or not. So in that case, we set objective equals to zero. And we just do this test and ask we can find alpha or not. So the output of SDPB is either it tell you it find dual feasible or prime feasible. If it's dual feasible, that means SDPB can explicitly construct that alpha. If it's prime feasible, it cannot find that alpha. So precisely what does this mean? I'm going to talk about it on Thursday. For now, you can just treat that as a black box. So this is actual output of SDPB. It's a specific computation for certain point, and that's a point that are disallowed. So the output of SDPB is this one. It says find a dual feasible jump. And that means it finds this alpha and excludes that specific point. For a lot of points, this is an example of the output. So precisely what's happening here, we'll discuss later. So another way using it, instead of test the points, test choice of delta, we can also bound the OP coefficient. So for example, let's consider single correlated bootstrap equation. And we isolate a specific term, and we write everything else on the right-hand side. And we ask the following question. Can we find a linear function of alpha such that alpha acting on this term is 1? And acting on all the terms here are positive for delta larger than certain gap, for example, your integrity bound. If we do find this alpha, then we let this alpha acting on both sides of the equation. On the left-hand side, that gave you lambda squared because alpha acting on this term is 1. And on the right-hand side, we have these two terms. But because we demand alpha acting on all the terms here are positive, so this term is positive. So that's this term minus some positive number. That's smaller than minus alpha acting on F0, 0. Therefore, if we find such alpha, we establish a bound on lambda O squared, because this has to be smaller than that value. So every alpha could satisfy those conditions will give us an inequality. If we want to find the most the strongest bound, then we want to find alpha such that it minimizes this term subject to this constraint. So that's maximize alpha acting on F0, 0. So this is a way to find the bound on the OP coefficient. After this computation, after you find this alpha, you can actually reconstruct the spectrum from it. So when you find the strongest bound on lambda squared, it must be the inequality are actually saturated. So it must be the physical spectrum are precisely zero in alpha. So alpha dot f is a function in lambda. So the physical spectrum must be zero of this function. So that this term is zero. Therefore, you get strongest bound. Therefore, after this computation, you can plot alpha dot f as a function of, as a function of delta, and the zero should correspond to physical spectrum. That's the extreme functional method. And once you get the spectrum in delta, you can put it back into this equation and try to find the OP coefficient that makes this equation hold. So basically, you can put some OP here and try, and the right hand side might not be zero, but it's some error, and you can try to minimize the error to find the OP coefficient.
So if you find all these zeros, it still doesn't mean that the physical spectrum is definitely a CFT, right? It's still a maybe.
If we find, basically, in this way, you find a solution to the truncated bootstrap equation. So when we actually do this, we first take the functional equation to finite dimension. Then this is the way to try to construct an approximate solution to that truncated bootstrap equation. Of course, because it's truncated bootstrap equation, that could be, you could have some error from the actual safety
so
data.
So that we only took maybe a few correlators, right? So this will not be some existence proof of a CFT, like rigorously speaking.
So this is an approximation to the CFT. It's not this is not rigorous, but this is rigorous.
Right.
So that truncation does not violate any symmetry. Right.
Could you repeat?
So I don't know if that truncation does not violate any symmetry, like conformal symmetry or.
This truncation. This truncation is based on conformal block, and the conformal block already used the conformal symmetry.
I mean, technically speaking, you truncate, so you don't have the contributions from all the descendants, so you don't have like full conformal symmetry, I guess. But it's an approximation.
But in the block, you already sum over all the descendants.
Descendants you have, you just don't have all the spins. You truncate at some high but finite spin.
Okay, so if we try to construct a special from EFM, that's an approximation. But when you do the positivity test, that's not approximation. You try to check whether the equation can hold in finite dimension. If we find it cannot hold in finite dimension, then it cannot hold in infinite dimension. That's the rigorous test.
Can I ask a question? So if you put a zero of the for the truncated crossing equation, put it back here, why would there be error? You're previously saying that if you put the zero and solving the OPE, there will be error. But why would there be error? It shouldn't be exactly zero, the right hand side.
This is a bit technical. For single correlator, that's essentially linear programming. In that case, you can precisely construct the solution. But for semi-definite program, I believe there is no, you can only construct the approximation to it. So for linear programming, the procedure guarantee you can find the solution. For semi-definite program, I think you can construct the solution to it, but probably, I don't know, there is no way to explicitly construct the solution.
This extremal function alpha dot f, is it likely to, because it's the solution to a truncated equation, is it likely to miss operators, or is it likely to give spurious operators? Is it likely to shift the dimensions of the operators by little?
Your question is, when you do truncation,
operator which is not the zero of alpha for the truncated.
You mean for the truncated system of so. For the truncated bootstrap equation, in this way you construct some approximation to that system. But those zero may not be the physical operator. Is this your question, whether the zero are really the actual operators?
But is there a one-to-one match between the number of zeros and the operators?
A one-to-one match between zeros and the solution to the truncated bootstrap equation.
No, not the full bootstrap equation before.
This usually those zero are only accurate for a small delta. For larger delta, definitely not. Actually, the number of physical operator is always infinite. But then this is finite. Dimension equation, you only have finite number of zero. Yeah.
So, sorry. The truncated equation still invariant under all conformal symmetry.
Uh, I think this depends on how you use it. If you use it to do the positivity test, then basically, I guess your question is this an approximation to conformal symmetry or the full conformal symmetry? That depends on how you use it. If you use it in this way, that's an approximation. But if you use it in positivity test, that's not an approximation. Because if you use it in positivity test, you are just trying to show the infinite dimensional equation cannot hold in finite dimension. If it cannot hold in finite dimension, it cannot hold in infinite dimension. So this statement has full conformal symmetry. That's a statement about infinite dimensional bootstrap equation. It has full conformal symmetry. But of course, if you are trying to construct an approximation solution to the truncated bootstrap equation, then that solution, of course, will not hold in infinite dimension. Then will not have a full conformal solution. I talked about how to solve SDP, but now we need to discuss a little bit about scan algorithms. So in this afternoon, we are going to use Delaunay search to scan points in data space. So in principle, you can just take a grid of points and scan this grid of points that give you a rough shape of the island. But then the boundary might not be precise. So there is more automatic way to refine the precision on the boundary. So that's Delaunay search. So basically, giving a set of points, there is a procedure called Delaunay triangularization. Basically, trying to connect those points and form triangles. But this procedure guarantee there is no point inside any circle of any triangle. So giving a set of points, we can form those triangles. Then Delaunay search is an adaptive method to scan the boundary of certain region. So we first scan a grid of points. And some points might be disallowed, which are red points here. Some points might be allowed. So after that, we apply Delaunay triangularization to all points. So we get some triangle. Then we ask, we try to find all the triangles that contain both allowed points and disallowed points. So that's triangles I plot here. Those triangles contain both red point and black point. So those triangles are the triangle on the boundary. So after we find those triangles, we try to look for the triangle with largest area. And then we scan the middle point in that triangle. So after you scan the middle point on that triangle, this triangle will split to three triangles. Therefore, we decreased the area of the largest triangle. So then you can repeat this process and refine the scan on the boundary. So this is how that works. So I start with some point. This point are allowed point. Those are disallowed point. Here, these five triangles are the triangle contain allowed and disallowed. Now, what we want to stand is this point, because this point is in the largest triangle. So this is all what happened. But now you can see this posture is not that good for the tip because it missed the tip. However, if we keep running it, eventually it will find the tip. So eventually, this is an actual computation for 3D Ethan Island. Okay, that's the end of the...
Could you please repeat once again on the previous slide, what was the procedure? So we have this triangulation and then what?
Okay, so the purpose of this algorithm is that we try to detect the boundary of the allowed region. So naive way would be you do a grid. But then in that way, if you want to find the precise boundary of it, you have to really make a dense sampling on the points. But this is an automatic way to do it. So you have a bunch of points. You apply denominator triangularization to it. You look for the triangle on the boundary. Those are triangle contain both allowed point and disallowed point. Then you stand the middle point of the largest triangle. After you stand the middle point of the largest triangle, this might be allowed or disallowed. No matter it's allowed or disallowed, this largest triangle will split to three triangles. Therefore, the area gets smaller. So after keep repeating this process, eventually, the boundary triangle will get smaller and smaller. And then you have a more higher resolution on the boundary. That's the basic idea.
Do you guarantee
to converge? Is this guaranteed to converge? I think the answer is no. If the region is nice enough, in practice, it converges. If the shape, the allowed region, have very singular shape, let's say if the allowed region have a very small strap here, it could, I think it will still be able to detect this. If we keep drawing a lot of points, eventually, the resolution will be high enough and detect that peak. But it might miss some disconnected region. Let's say if there is a large region here, but your initial grid missed that point, then it could miss it. Maybe your question is for the connected region, whether it converge or not. I think it will converge eventually.
You have some fractional structure.
Okay, that's the end of this lecture. And in the afternoon, I'm going to show you how to scan this island in Simple Boot. Thank you.